This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. With the words, "There's a special place in hell for women who don't support other women," former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was back in the headlines. While she's long uttered that phrase, it was when she said them at a campaign rally for Hillary Clinton that sparked a national debate about feminism. Albright has been a pioneer for women ever since becoming the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President Bill Clinton in 1993. She went on to become the first female Secretary of State. We talked about her life and lessons learned serving in a presidential cabinet when she joined us in 2003. That's when her memoir, Madam Secretary, was published. Let's take a listen. You write in the preface to this book that you wanted this memoir to be different from other secretaries of state, and you wanted to combine the personal with the policy. Is that something you think that women do more than men, or is that something about you?
Well, I do think that women do it more than men because I think we see our life as a whole and we don't try to separate various parts of it. But I also thought it was very important for people to know who I am, given the kinds of decisions that I made, and understand that I am an immigrant, that it took me a while as a woman to put my career together. So I do think that I wasn't like other secretaries of state, so that's why I thought I'd do a different kind of memoir.
Well, you're an immigrant with no discernible accent.
Well, I grew up in England. I did have a very English accent, and since we're about to come up on Thanksgiving, I remember so well the first Thanksgiving. We were in Great Neck, New York, and we were singing We Gather Together, and all of a sudden I heard somebody asking God's blessing while the other people were asking, and I quickly lost my very British accent.
And sounded like an American.
Sounded like an American, which is what I wanted to be more than anything else, was to grow up an American.
Well, I was surprised to read that you said you were never supposed to be what you became. As a young woman, what did you think your life was going to be?
Well, I had no idea. You know, I could have just grown up in Czechoslovakia and been the daughter of a diplomat, probably a professor. I could have stayed there under a communist regime in which I would have hoped I would have been a dissident. I could have been a happily married woman with three children who did a lot of volunteer work. But it all turned out quite differently, and I've loved every part of it.
Well, it seems as if a turning point for you was the divorce that you got from your husband. And this was a divorce, I guess, that he handed you. He wanted to actually leave you. What was the impact on you at that time?
Well, I was stunned, to say the least. I'd been married for 23 years, and I thought happily with a husband who had been truly supportive of everything that I'd done, getting my PhD for an overly long period of time, my various escapades in political campaigns, and then working for Senator Muskie, and then in the White House. He had always been very supportive, but all of a sudden he arrived and said he was in love with somebody else, and it was a stunning shock. I do think it drove me to work harder. At first, I think just to kind of stay busy because my kids were grown up. One thing led to another. I have a very hard part in the book where I still can't figure out exactly how I respond to it.
Well, let me just read a couple of lines from that because it struck me as well. There are many contradictions in the way that I feel, and this was about the divorce. When I became Secretary of State, I realized that though others might, I would never have climbed that high had I still been married. Yet I was deeply saddened to have been divorced. I know at the time that I would have given up any thought of a career if I would have made Joe change his mind.
Well, that is how it really was. And I would have given up anything because I was trying to analyze what it is that made him leave and whether it was because I had a career, which I resent even the thought of. As I said, I hate being asked that question, but I don't know the answer to it. I loved being Secretary of State, and so it is kind of a contradiction in my own head.
Well, he gave you a curious ultimatum, and it had to do with a Pulitzer Prize, whether he was going to win or lose it, and that was going to decide the fate of this marriage.
Well, it was really strange, and when I wrote that down, my editor said, "Are you kidding?" But that is what happened, and I think only he can explain why that kind of trade-off existed.
And he said if he had won, he was a journalist, if he had won the Pulitzer Prize, he would have stayed married.
That is what he said, or married to me. Anyway.
Married to you.
And I think that it had a lot to do with his baggage and his life, and at first, I like so many women, I thought the whole thing was my fault. But the more that I analyzed it. I think it obviously takes two people, and there's a lot in his background, I think, that made this happen.
Well, this is something that happened 20 years ago, and yet you also write about after he left, going to a supermarket and not being sure what kind of cereal you liked because you had spent so much time trying to, I guess, feed your family and give them what they like.
Well, the reason I decided to write so honestly this particular chapter, which is very personal, is that I think other women and men have gone through this, and you begin to think of yourself as a we and make decisions that are only based on how other people feel rather than on your own thoughts. And to me, it was so symptomatic of the fact that I honestly didn't know whether I liked shredded wheat or Cheerios, and I didn't like steak, which is what I'd been eating for 23 years.
And you figured that out.
Yeah. I mean, it isn't exactly brain surgery, but it was an issue of trying to figure out how to make decisions on my own.
There's a quote you gave to the New York Times, a reporter, Elaine Scalino, where you said, "I'm not that smart. I work very hard." Is that a true description of you, do you think?
Well, I was told that it was not a good quote and that it was picked up in a way that was misunderstood. I think it's quite a girl thing to say. So I regret saying it because I actually think I'm pretty smart. But I do work hard. I really do work hard. And, Hillary Clinton said to me, "Why did you say something like that when we know you're smart?"
And it's a girl thing because girls underestimate their abilities?
I think so. You know, I think we basically are unsure of ourselves many times. And when a woman is sure of herself, then she's criticized and called a lot of names that probably are not appropriate on radio.
You talk about being female U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and then Secretary of State and being asked about dealing with the sexism around the world. And you have an interesting comment about that, essentially that dealing with the old boys network in the United States was a lot harder than dealing with men in Arab countries, to use the stereotype.
Yes, because, you know, when I dealt with foreign men, especially those in Arab countries, they knew that if they were going to talk to the United States, I was the Secretary of State. I was the channel through which to talk. I did arrive in a large plane that said United States of America
that
on
helps,
it,
doesn't it,
which did help. But they knew there I was. I was the United States for that particular time. Whereas the men in my own government, not that they were nasty people. I have to say that. I mean, they basically are all kind, generous people. But I think, in my own explanation, is I think they'd known me too long through a variety of different stages. They knew me as a wife. They knew me as somebody that was a friend of their wife's or the carpool mother or a staffer for Senator Muskie and not somebody all of a sudden that kind of leapt mm-hmm. over them and became the first woman Secretary of State. So it made in some of them kind of a sense of being a little dismissive of what I had to say or if I felt strongly about something, which I often did, I was called emotional, whereas I think a man would be called, really confident and convinced. And I ran into something that I think many, many women run into. This was not unusual.
How did you learn that President Clinton wanted you to be his UN secretary?
Well, you know, I did not believe I would become Secretary of State. And some of my friends, my chief of staff, Elaine Shoka, said, "Yes, you will," and I just did not believe it because there's a lot of competition. There had been an article in the paper which said I was second tier, which obviously made me mad and made a lot of women mad. But I couldn't rely on the fact that President Clinton would name me just because I was a woman, because he'd already named Janet Reno to the highest level position, and he had really elevated many women in the administration, so I couldn't count on that. But the way I learned about it was that one night, Erskine Bowles, who was the chief of staff, called me. I was in New York doing my job, and he said, "If the president of the United States were to call you tomorrow, would you take the call? And if he were to ask you to be Secretary of State, would you say yes?" And I thought, who in God's name would say no to either of those questions? And he said, "Well, go to Washington, and he'll call you early in the morning." So I rushed down there, and then forgetting that I was dealing with Bill Clinton, who didn't start real early in the morning, I waited. I didn't even take a shower. I sat there in my pink terry cloth bathrobe waiting for the call, which at 9:47 finally came. The White House operator said, hold for the president. Then some horrible music came on. And then I thought, he's changed his mind. He's definitely changed his mind. And he's calling to tell me he's changed his mind. And he got on the phone. He said, I want you to be my Secretary of State, which is the first time that I really believed it.
Wow. And that does make you then the highest ranking female in the American government ever.
Yes, and it was. I was so proud to be Secretary of State, and especially since I hadn't been born here. I mean, it really was something. I hoped that I could spend my time as Secretary repaying the generosity of the American people for allowing me to grow up here.
Kissinger said, "Welcome to the fraternity."
That was very funny because he hadn't even known what he said, and I said, "You know, Henry, it's not a fraternity anymore."
Well, even before that, you were the U.S. representative at the United Nations, dealing with many things, which you write about in the book, including Somalia, including Rwanda, and of course later on in Kosovo as well. What did you learn about the United Nations that you think prepared you for Secretary of State?
Well, first of all, the vast number of issues with which we dealt, because it really required me to learn a lot about all the places that we were dealing with. So it was incredibly good grounding. It also made me understand the views of other countries because I dealt with more different kinds of foreigners per square inch than any other American representative. I mean, the ambassador to Germany dealt with more Germans, for instance, but I dealt with this variety of people. And the only way I can describe it was that you could see the effect of a decision that you made, how it affected vast numbers of countries. So it's a little bit like a pool table where you hit one ball, it hits a bunch of others, and there are all kinds of effects that come from a particular policy. So it made me understand the importance of multilateral diplomacy and the difficulties of it and the worthwhileness of it.
That was my 2003 interview with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who joined us when her memoir, Madam Secretary, was published. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the life of Harper Lee. The author of To Kill a Mockingbird died last weekend at the age of 89. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks again for joining us. Harper Lee died last weekend at the age of 89. She was the author of one of the most famous and well-regarded novels in American history, the 1960 Pulitzer Prize-winning To Kill a Mockingbird. The long-anticipated sequel to the book called Go Set a Watchman was published last year and kicked up some controversy. We learned all about Lee's life and its parallels to Mockingbird's narrator, the precocious tomboy scout, when Charles Shields joined us in 2006. That's when his book Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, was published. Let's take a listen. Do you understand, even respect her desire for privacy, even if it frustrated your work writing this book?
She's entitled to do that, and I understand her reasons, too. You have to understand that she was absolutely stunned by the success of To Kill a Mockingbird. As she told her editor, all I was hoping for was a merciful death at the hands of the reviewers. And she was cautioned by her editor, Tay Hohoff at Lippincott, that they may only sell 2,500 copies. But for a first-time novelist, that wasn't too bad. Instead, she ends up on the bestseller lists across the country, and remains there for about 88 weeks. Then she wins the Pulitzer Prize. Then her novel is made into a major motion picture, which is nominated for 8 Academy Awards and wins 3. She is just thunderstruck, as was everybody who knew her. And then she started talking about the second novel that she was working on. And up until 1965, she told interviewers that she was indeed working on a second book. It never came about, and she quite honestly got tired of talking about To Kill a Mockingbird and got tired of being questioned about the second book that she was working on. When the second book didn't appear, she just retreated into an ordinary life.
But did you wrestle with yourself this idea of writing a book about someone who didn't want to be written about and had retreated, as you say, sort of back to this town where she grew up in?
Well, you know, this is what was my intention when I started out writing the book. I wanted to tell the story of the woman who had written To Kill a Mockingbird, and I wanted to tell about how the book came to be. It was never my intention to write an expose about her. I didn't want to incur the hatred of millions of her fans by, you know, revealing things that were just gratuitously mean. So instead, I tried to conduct myself like a gentleman the entire 4 years that I worked on the book. And when people didn't want to speak to me, I didn't press them. And I didn't explore areas that I didn't think were germane to the nature of the novel. You know, I've often been asked about Harper Lee's love life or aspects of her growing up that, you know, may cast her in an unflattering way. And really, if it had nothing to do with the creation of the book or it didn't steer her life in a particular direction, I didn't deal with it.
Do you think, though, that and it's hard not to see some of the parallels between Monroeville, Alabama, where she grew up, and Maycomb, which is the story of where To Kill a Mockingbird is set. Do you see parallels between those two places?
Oh, yes. To Kill a Mockingbird is highly autobiographical. Scout is Harper Lee, and Atticus is her father, A.C. Lee. And Dill, the blonde-haired boy next door, is Truman Capote. And some of the things that happened, the mad dog in the summertime, although her father didn't shoot a mad dog, but rabies from dogs were always a problem in, you know, the hot summer weather in the South. All those kinds of things play into her memories of the past and how she wrote the book. I should say, too, that the rape trial of Tom Robinson was not based on the Scottsboro boys, as a lot of people think, the famous, well, I should say infamous trial of 9 boys arrested for the rape of 2 women. It's based on the trial of a man named Walter Lett, who was a Monroeville native and who went to trial at the courthouse where her father practiced law for supposedly raping a white woman. And he was sentenced to be executed, and then his sentence was commuted to life in prison. It was a lurid trial. It was on the minds of everybody in Monroeville, and as a young person, Harper Lee would have heard a lot about it.
And he actually died in a mental hospital.
Yes, it's a very sad story. Walter Lett was in all probability not guilty of that he was accused of. In fact, a petition was got up after he was convicted by leading citizens of Monroeville, and I wouldn't be surprised if A.C. Lee's signature was on that petition as well. Harper Lee's father was sent to the governor pleading that this man was a good man, and he was probably at work at the time of the alleged crime. So the governor commuted his sentence to life instead of death. But unfortunately, Walter Lett had lost his mind at Kilby State Prison by that time and was in a catatonic state. He was moved to an insane asylum where he died of tuberculosis several years later and returned to his mother in a boxcar.
Well, as you say, Harper Lee and Scout have a lot in common. In fact, in many ways, Scout, I guess, is Harper Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Harper Lee was a tomboy, and she had this nickname, Miss Frippy Britches?
Yeah, I picked that up from the memories of Truman Capote's aunt, Marie Rudisill. She remembers that term being used. It's like Little Mister, you know, or something like that. It's just an endearing kind of name. She and Truman embraced each other because they were sort of a yin yang relationship. He was too soft for boys, and she was too tough for girls. Yet they were both precocious. They both loved reading, and they were literally next door neighbors. And so they recognized in each other kindred spirits. And Harper Lee beat up Truman several times when he tried to test her loyalty. They had a very interesting relationship, a lifelong relationship, in fact.
which I do want to get to, but I want to try to do this as chronologically as we possibly can. I mean, she truly was the tomboy that we see scout with an independent streak, a very kind of anti-authoritarian kid.
Yes. In fact, her fourth grade teacher was astonished on the first day of school when Harper Lee called the teacher by her first name, Leighton. Her name was Leighton McNeil, I think. And when the teacher said, you don't talk to adults like that, Harper Lee was surprised and said, I call my father A.C.
And then
you notice that Scout calls her father Atticus.
Would you say that Harper Lee's family then, most particularly her father, were liberal when it came to race relations in that time, at that place in the Deep South?
Well, you know, Harper Lee's father, A.C., was a very educated man and a thoughtful man, a deep thinker, like Atticus is described in the book by some men on the courthouse lawn who were watching him walk by. But I have to say that he was a man of his generation, and typical of Southerners at that time. He believed in segregation as a positive good. He thought that the races were better off not being forced to intermix, and that it just led to peace and a kind of a civil quiet. But he changed as he grew older, and largely through the influence of his daughter, Alice Lee. Alice Lee is an attorney. She's 95 years old, and she still practices law.
Amazing.
She's been a moving force in the Methodist Church in southern Alabama, particularly moving it in the direction of integration during the 1960s and 1970s. And through her influence, A.C. Lee, at the end of his life, was much more liberal than he was earlier in his life. In fact, near the end of his life, he was overheard to be talking about the dire need for redistricting and giving blacks a fairer voice in the politics in Alabama.
Would you say that Alice also influenced her younger sister, Harper Lee, when it came to race relations?
Yes, because, you know, it was a very intellectual household. I mean, here is Harper Lee as a young woman sitting at a table with her father, who's a lawyer, a newspaper editor, and a state legislator, three times elected, her eldest sister, who's also an attorney. Her mother read a great deal as well. And so you can imagine that the level of conversation at the dinner table was full of ideas and full of talk about history and the nature of their town, and I think that's where Harper Lee first began to realize that there was much more below the surface to life in Monroeville than what seemed to be.
Interesting. Well, when did she show signs that she could be a writer, that she was a writer? I know she was a very good student, as you write about her in your book.
Mm-hmm. Well, she had a very influential high school teacher named Gladys Watson, who lived across the street from the Lees on South Alabama Avenue. And Gladys Watson was just an inspired English teacher, and everybody had to have her for 4 years. It was a very small high school, and you would take her for introductory English, and then you would take her for a British Lit, and then you would take her for American Lit. So everybody got a big dose of Gladys. And she loved to read, Miss Watson did, Chaucer included, and she would read aloud to the students, and she would have them read their compositions aloud. And everyone I spoke to who had her just raved about the impact that she had. And, of course, Nell Harper Lee had her as a student. And I think that's when Nell became fascinated by British literature and took Jane Austen as her model. Because Harper Lee later in life said that all she wanted to be was the Jane Austen of South Alabama.
Huh. In fact, she didn't seem to be much interested in American literature.
No, as a matter of fact, when she was asked about the types of books that she preferred, she would mention the Lambs, you know, the brother and sister writers, and Robert Louis Stevenson and Jane Austen, and 19th century novelists were her favorite.
Interesting. Now, she did study law for a while when she was in college, but she didn't complete her degree.
Yeah, she was torn. You asked about, you know, when was the first evidence of her being a good writer. She was torn in college between pursuing law and pursuing writing, and eventually writing one out. She started writing columns for the campus newspaper, The Crimson White, and they were just comments on the passing scene, a little satiric send-ups about, how difficult registration was for students and that sort of thing. And then she moved over and became editor of The Rammer Jammer, which was a humor magazine on campus, and she wrote about some racial issues in there that were unusual for that time. The University of Alabama was often called the country club of the South, and racial issues were not talked about, but yet she satirized race division. She went to school, she went to law school, as you mentioned, but she didn't finish. She dropped out about a semester short and announced to her crestfallen father that she was going to be a writer. And A.C. Lee had been hoping that she would join the law firm like her sister Alice had, and that someday, as he told his friends at Rotary, he might have to rename the law firm Lee and Daughters Attorney.
And yet she had these friends, and I thought this was an extraordinary act of generosity on their part. But maybe they saw the writer in her. The Browns gave her money so that she could write full time.
Yes, I should say that that was one of the most challenging pieces of detective work that I had to do to find out who the Browns were. And I should say that my researching abilities, I think, come honestly. My father used to be a reporter for the Philadelphia Bulletin.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, many years ago. But in any event, I wanted to find out who the Browns were because they were the angels that gave her money to continue her work on her novel. And yet in the article that she wrote for a women's magazine back in 1963 describing their gift, she never mentioned their names.
Huh.
So I went through her agent's papers at Columbia University and found a photograph of Nell Harper Lee, and on the back of it, it said Michael Brown. And I thought, well, Michael Brown, that's a name I haven't heard of before. So I went to the Rolodex that was part of the papers in her agent's papers, and here's Michael Martin Brown and an address. And I went to the phone book for 2004, and indeed, Michael Martin Brown still lived at the same address 45 years later. So I called them up, and Joy Brown answered the phone, and I told her who I was, and I wanted to ask her about this Christmas because I had heard that they were the people who gave Nell the gift, and she just gasped. And she said, I'm going to have lunch with Nell tomorrow. I'll have to call you back. And she called me back the next day and said, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you.
Oh.
So sometimes I would run into dead ends like that, but knowing who they were and knowing that Michael Martin Brown was a Broadway lyricist opened up more doors because I knew people who knew him, and I could create a better portrait of what their life was like together as friends.
Charles, let me get back to the story of the writing of To Kill a Mockingbird. And as you said, she and I think probably others were surprised at what a popular book it was and also the important awards it got, including the Pulitzer Prize. And she's quoted as saying in a 1964 interview, well, I can't say that it was one of surprise. It was one of sheer numbness. It was like being hit over the head and knocked cold. You see, I never expected any sort of success with Mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think she didn't? And why do you think the book was such an instant success back in the early 1960s?
Well, she was cautioned by her editor, Tay Hohoff, not to get her hopes up too high, that she was an unknown, a first-time novelist. There had been other books written about sort of the Tobacco Road South that had received mixed reviews. Also, I think Hohoff, being a lifelong New Yorker, knew that stories about the Deep South oftentimes didn't wash well with reviewers. It was not a territory they were familiar with, and the book may come off as unsophisticated to some people.
Hmm.
So in any event, Nell is carrying all these things in her mind and hoping that at least it gets maybe 2,000 readers, and instead, millions of people are interested in it. It's very successful because it speaks to some essential things that we all care about, tolerance and justice, how we treat one another, also some of the principles that we hold dear in this country, a person's constitutional rights. As Atticus says in the courtroom, he turns to the jury and he says, for God's sake, do your duty, after reminding them about thoughts said by Jefferson and phrases in the Constitution. So it's a powerful book because it reminds us of who we want to be as a society.
Was she involved in the making of the movie To Kill a Mockingbird, of course, starring Gregory Peck?
Well, she was consulted on the progress of the movie. I don't know whether you know it. I mentioned it in my book, but there were a number of people who were interested in playing the role of Atticus.
Yes, indeed.
Some of them were kind of hilarious. Bing Crosby.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Robert Wagner had an interest in being Atticus. Now Harper Lee envisioned Spencer Tracy in the role.
Wow. I can't see anyone but Gregory Peck. But
right, exactly. She was offered the opportunity to write the screenplay, But she said no because she didn't have experience in that regard. However, it was given to Horton Foote, who was also a Southerner and raised in a small town, and they liked each other a great deal. And so Nell felt confident that Horton Foote would do a good job. And when she saw the finished film, and she did go to the set for a couple of days, when she saw the finished film, she said, Makeham is there and all of its people, too.
Oh, so she was pleased.
Yes.
That was my 2006 conversation with biographer Charles Shields about his book Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee. When we get back from the break, we'll get New York Times film critic A.O. Scott's picks for the best films of the past year as Oscar weekend approaches. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The Academy Awards are coming up this weekend, and beyond the red carpet glitz, the lighthearted jabs from the host, Chris Rock, this year, and the musical numbers, there are those little statues that honor the best work in filmmaking of the last year. Earlier this week, we were joined by New York Times film critic A.O. Scott, who filled us in on some of his favorite movies of the year, including some that have been nominated for an Oscar. Let's listen. I do want to talk about the Oscars, the Academy Awards, Sunday night. I'm looking at your top 20 list. You couldn't confine yourself to the top 10 for the movies of 2015. A good year for movies?
It was a good year for movies. It was maybe surprisingly a good year for big commercial movies. One of the great ironies of 2015 is that critics and other writers and you know not just journalists, but audience members have been complaining for years about sequels and reboots and the absence of originality and all of these franchises. And then this year, some of the most interesting movies, several on my list, fit exactly that profile. So you had Mad Max: Fury Road, terrifically exciting movie, great, you know, the great feminist allegory of our times. That is, you know, the reboot of a more than 30-year-old franchise. Then toward the end of the year, the great surprise and delight for me was seeing Creed. I know I'm speaking to a hometown crowd here, but Creed, again, it's like this is I went to the early screening in the fall thinking, oh, this is the seventh Rocky movie. You know, what is this going to be? I mean, I had seen the director Ryan Coogler's first film, Fruitvale Station, which I liked a lot, Michael B. Jordan is just a terrific and exciting young actor. But that movie took all of the cliches of the boxing movie and took the story template of the first Rocky movie and found something fresh and new and exciting to do with it. And to get back for a second to the Oscars, the evidence for me of the problem with the Oscars is that its conception, the Academy's conception of what is quality, is too narrow in a way to include a movie like Creed, to see just what that movie is doing, and in part that is, I think, That does have to do with the racial issue, because it's a movie about a young African American man pursuing his dream, you know, learning his craft, falling in love, and it's a very rich and nuanced and very precise picture of African American life
with a great actor who I think was dissed by the Oscars, Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, I think his day will come, but yeah, absolutely.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with A.O. Scott about movies. He's movie critic for The New York Times, author of this new book, Better Living Through Criticism. And we pulled a couple of movies that were on his top 20 list for 2015. This is number two, and this is the film Inside Out. Amy Poehler plays Joy. Bill Hader is Fear. Mindy Kaling is Disgust. Lewis Black is Anger. Phyllis Smith is Sadness. And they're all getting ready for Riley's first day of school. These are all the emotions within this young character.
First day of school, very, very exciting. I was up late last night figuring out a new plan. Here it is. Fear. I need a list of all the possible negative outcomes on the first day at a new school.
Way ahead of you there. Does anyone know how to spell meteor?
Disgust. Make sure Riley stands out today, but also blends in.
When I'm through, Riley will look so good, the other kids will look at their own outfits and barf.
Joy.
Yes, Joy?
You'll be in charge of the console, keeping Riley happy all day long. And may I add, I love your dress. It's adorable. Oh, this old thing? Thank you so much. I love the way it twirls. Train of thought, right on schedule. Anger. Unload the daydreams. I ordered extra in case things get slow in class.
Might come in handy. If this new school is full of boring, useless classes, which it probably will be.
Oh, sadness. I have a super important job just for you.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Follow me.
What are you doing?
And there. Perfect. This is the circle of sadness. Your job is to make sure that all the sadness stays inside of it.
A clip from a film that our guest really, really liked, Inside Out.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful movie. I mean, it's kind of brilliant at that early stage, because it's all of these voices that you might recognize from different sitcoms. And it is kind of a workplace sitcom. It's about all these people, you know, or emotions, whatever, personified emotions, who are coming to the office being this young girl's brain. And there's all this kind of competition between them, and they're trying to figure out whose job is to do what. And then the movie takes this very interesting and lovely turn. You know, you think that Joy, Amy Poehler, is the hero of it, and she's certainly, you know, in classic Leslie Knope style, sort of, you know, bossing everyone around and taking control of things. But it's Sadness's movie, and it's a movie about the importance of mixed emotions, the importance in a maturing mind and personality of sorrow, of regret, of loss, and I thought it was it was so beautifully told, with so much imagination and so much of that typical kind of Pixar visual inventiveness that you know, how you picture and a huge challenge, you know, how do you picture consciousness? how do you make that something that you can look at and something you can see? So it was just, I thought, at the very highest, I have liked a lot of Pixar movies. In the book, there's a long discussion at the end of Ratatouille,
which you really love,
which I really love, yes. and has the, you know, the character that I probably identify most with, Anton Ego, in all of movies, who I insist is the secret hero of that movie, because he's a critic. but yeah, I mean, Inside Out was just a marvel. Yeah.
Let me play a movie that you liked last year. This is The Big Short, and this is a scene where hedge fund manager Michael Burry, played by Christian Bale, is confronted over his prediction of the 2007 housing market collapse.
We have no confidence in your ability to identify macroeconomic trends.
You flew here to tell me that? Why? Anyone can see that there's a real estate bubble.
Actually, no one can see a bubble. That's what makes it a bubble.
That's dumb, Lawrence. It's always markers. Mortgage fraud, quintupled since 2000, and the average take-home pay. It's flat, but home prices are soaring. That means the homes are debt, not assets.
So Mike Burry, a guy who gets his hair cut at Supercuts and doesn't wear shoes,
knows more than Alan Greenspan and Hank Paulson.
Yeah, Dr. Mightbury. Yes, he does.
Our guest, A.O. Scott, said this is a terrifically enjoyable movie that leaves you in a stage of rage, nausea, and despair. As soon as I'm done writing this, I'm going to go to the garage to look for a pitchfork.
Well, this is I think Adam McKay, who's been, you know, director of comedies up until now, you know, learned a lot working on, say, those Anchorman movies about how to keep a story moving, how to entertain an audience, how to throw curveballs. And he tells this very upsetting but also very complicated and abstract story about the financial crash of 2008 and about a bunch of people who figured it out, who shorted the market, who kind of who profited in a way from the misery of everybody else. But it turns at the end to a very kind of stark and angry reckoning with what happened, with how you know, the big banks destroyed the economy and you know, brought havoc and misery to a lot of people's lives, and then basically got off with impunity. So it's a movie that manages the turn from you kind of feeling sort of giddy and exuberant, and it's moving so quickly, and you're kind of caught up in the caper aspect of the story, and then it kind of pulls the rug out from under you, and you're like, oh my gosh, right. Oh my God.
Let me do another one, and this is Spotlight, another film that you really liked from 2015. In this clip, this is about the Boston Globe Spotlight team, an investigative team, and they're discussing Boston's Catholic priest sex abuse scandal.
Law had to know. That's why he had the reaction, because he knew there were others.
I think that's the bigger story.
But the numbers clearly indicate that there were senior clergy involved.
That's all they do. Indicator.
Are you telling me that if we run a store with 50 pedophile priests in Boston...
Mike, we'll get into the same catfight you got into on Porter, which made a lot of noise, but changed things not one bit. We need to focus on the institution, not the individual priests. Practice and policy. Show me the church manipulated the system so that these guys wouldn't have to face charges. Show me they put those same priests back into parishes time and time again. Show me this was systemic, that it came from the top down.
Sounds like we're going after Law.
That would be Cardinal Law.
Yeah.
So why did you like this movie?
Well, I partly like this movie because I work at a newspaper. And and it's, I mean, there have been a lot of newspaper pictures over the years going, you know, all the way back to His Girl Friday and Citizen Kane and up through All the President's Men. I felt like this one really got the feeling of newsroom life just about as well as any I can think of. And you know, while it certainly is in some ways a heroic story of these investigative journalists uncovering this scandal and the reach of it and how high up it went in the Roman Catholic hierarchy in Boston, it's also about the flaws and the self-imposed obstacles that journalists face. They you know, in a way, they got to the story too late. And what you hear in that scene is a very good depiction of what happens in newsrooms when you're trying to figure out what the story is. And you know, the some of the editors and reporters, you know, say, well, we want to the story is all of these priests and what they did. And then you hear their boss, Marty Baron, played by Liev Schreiber, who's now running the Washington Post, who saying, well, no, maybe the story is the system, is the structure, is the power. And I think this movie did an excellent job of kind of getting into those procedural details of like, well, what are you looking for? How do you put it together? When do you decide to publish it? When do you hold off? These are often very difficult decisions, and they depend on the hunches and the judgment and the instincts of the editors and the reporters. So I thought it did a very good job of that, and also a very good job of conveying how enormous and how horrible this story is without sensationalizing it.
You so never you, see a child.
You, yeah, you never
hardly see a priest.
Exactly. You see and the most kind of heart-stopping and horrifying scenes are people looking through documents. You know.
Let me play one more that we sure. pulled out, and this was also on your list of 2015's best movies. A scene from Carol, and in this scene, Therese, who's played by Rooney Mara, decides to go on a trip with Carol, played by Cate Blanchett, and Jake is played by Richard Semko. He's feeling threatened and accuses Therese of having a crush on Carol.
You got one hell of a crush on this woman, is what? You're like a schoolgirl.
I do not. I just like her is all. I'm fond of anyone I can really talk to.
Nice. You know what I think? I think 2 weeks from now, you're going to be wishing that she's going to get tired of you, and you're going to wish that you would never...
You don't understand.
Oh, I do. I understand completely. You're in a trance.
I'm wide awake. I've never been more awake in my life. Why don't you leave me alone?
A scene from Carol, directed by Todd Haynes.
Yeah, a movie that I think should have gotten more love from the Academy, maybe. I mean, Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett both got nominations, although they kind of got the wrong ones. I think that Rooney Mara is up for supporting actress, is really the lead in this movie. I think it is Therese who's at the center of this story. But I think it's a beautifully told love story. I mean, it has wonderful period detail and fabulous costumes, but a very rich and subtle emotional texture as well. And I think that Todd Haynes somehow depicts the desire that kind of sparks between these two women and their different ways of dealing with it and of making sense of it and understanding what is happening to them.
I mean, it's to my eyes, it was a movie about looking.
Yes,
the way they looked at each other and as you say, there was this amazing spark connection.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think Haynes uses the camera so well to change angles and change perspectives so that you're really aware of the gaze and who is looking at whom and what they're seeing.
Let me read an email from Cletus. He said, my first paycheck job after Paperboy was usher in a twin theater, sought to serve with love 85 times before I realized we could hang and talk with the refreshment girls in the lobby. That sparked my intense interest in both popcorn and art house films. The Seven Samurai, for the same reasons mentioned earlier about unforgettably and individual character development. Any thoughts from the critic about that particular film, which would be The Seven Samurai?
Oh, well, that's a wonderful movie. I don't know what more to say. It's terrific. I too, you know, was kind of had early encounters with foreign language films and with Japanese and Italian and French films, and there is something about that kind of discovery of these different worlds of storytelling, these different kinds of heroes that is always it's just always intriguing, and that I hope, you know, young people are still doing that you know,
making those kinds of movies.
Well, and seeing them. I mean, kind of casting a slightly wider net and allowing their curiosity to take them beyond just Hollywood and beyond just American or English language films.
Again, that was my interview with New York Times film critic A.O. Scott about some of his picks for the best films of 2015. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.